That was, yeah. No, it wasn't.
You don't know what our pregame laughs are about, do you, people? We'll tell you one day. We'll record
one day the secrets will be told.
Yes.
Welcome to Open Source is Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me is...
Scotty Hertz here on Open Source is the capital of shows. Oh. That's a yeah. At least for Wellington County.
We're going to...
On community radio.
We're about to start the Days of Rage from Planet Groove and
Capital
Silver Scream,
moved.
Dream Machine, and DJ Sounds Good to Me, and it's going to be nuts. Of course, Ed Credits will align itself with open sources, because anyone...
You need to know who your allies are.
That's
on this
right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Open Sources is CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show, and you can listen to us live here on CFRU every Thursday at 5 p.m. You can also listen to us live online. Go to CFRU.ca, click on the Listen Now icon at the top right-hand corner of your screen, and you can listen to us anytime by downloading the Open Sources podcast on Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. Today, we will stand in judgment of William Morneau, Canada's Minister of Finance, and cast him as an innocent dupe or greedy supervillain, because he can only be one of those two things. And then... we will wrap up the City of Guelph's 2018 budget with a visit from Councillors Phil Ault and Kathy Downer to talk about what went right, what went wrong, about the budget process this year, and whether or not they and us should be happy about the result. And I think we might know their answer, but we'll have to wait and see for the bottom of the hour. But first, we dive back into Trump world again. No less than the fourth member of President Donald Trump's inner circle has been indicted in relation to Russian collusion in the 2016 presidential election. This time it was the much beleaguered former National Security Advisor Michael J. Flynn, he who famously said, lock her up, and if he had done a tenth of what Hillary Clinton had supposedly done, he would be in jail. And I guess he was right.
Yeah, I think people get this impression, I think, a little bit that Flynn is going to be some kind of good guy that's going to bring Trump down, but Flynn isn't really one of the good guys, let's say, although he may... No. Precipitate the fall of Trump or aid the wheels in motion. So here's what's happening. I think Trump had a couple of Big Macs or whatever and then let it rip on Twitter on the weekend about General Flynn, calling General Flynn a, quote, liar, yeah. Among other things. Trump was definitely both barrels on the Twitter on the weekend, saying that he lied to the FBI. He's talking about Flynn. This is Trump talking about Flynn, and pleaded guilty to those lies. But he's a good guy at the same time. Or is he, I guess he's not a good guy anymore in Trump's book,
mm-hmm.
Or in anybody's book, probably. But he may be if he as I said, gets the wheels in motion to the fall of Trump. So just so people know, this is all going toward it's evidence that is being gathered towards the Russian interference inquiry. Famously, the Mueller inquiry. We've talked about it a lot. Mm-hmm. Mueller is special counsel for that inquiry, and this will be one piece of the puzzle.
Mueller.
Hello, Mueller. You can't. It's impossible to impeach or bring a president down with on the strength of one tweet, unless he said, "I murdered somebody." But even then, there's procedural stuff, right? So, I thought the weird thing of the weekend was Trump's lawyer taking the credit for Trump's tweet.
Yeah.
Because we know, or at least strongly given the impression that Trump is in, it's one of the things that he is incomplete control on. You can tell when Trump is reading the prompter because he butchers the words. But in terms of Twitter, I think the Twitter is his, and they're, you know, until they pry his BlackBerry from his cold dead hands or whatever he's using.
Android.
Palm Pilot. my stylus is missing. There's no way that he didn't send that tweet, even though this lawyer said. Although the lawyer wasn't under oath, I suppose, saying that he actually sent that tweet for Trump. So he also said that the other thing that he said, which was telling, was that in his view, this is John Dowd, Trump's lawyer, one of his lawyers,
yeah.
That the president can't obstruct justice.
Yeah.
But he's forgotten about Richard Nixon,
yeah.
Who didn't tweet, but he recorded absolutely every single conversation in his office.
Yeah, so it was like he was tweeting.
Reel to reel in 1970, whatever, was the equivalent of tweeting, just sort of accumulating information. So will this bring Trump down? Probably not, but it's certainly going to add to the case.
Whatever
comes of it anyway.
It makes it more complicated for Trump, that's for sure. And yeah, the whole thing with Dowd taking credit for the tweet, it's like, you did not. A lawyer does not craft that tweet. A lawyer doesn't, like, craft the tweet to make it sound like it came from the nimble fingers of the person whose Twitter account that comes from. There was no sense of legalese at all in that tweet. It was
no.
It was a complete fire. It's funny you mentioned two Big Macs. I think Trump's actual snack was two Big Macs, two Filet-O-Fish, and a chocolate malt. But that's neither here nor there.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
That's from the Lewandowski book, right?
Oh, of course. Yes.
That on the yeah. on Trump Force One, which is what they called the plane, apparently.
Get off my plane! Unless you got a Big Mac, then you can come on.
Enough about the Air Force One connection. I think Trump loves that movie because he thinks he'd be Harrison Ford in that movie. But we all know if Donald Trump found himself in an Air Force One situation, he'd
parachute.
Be in the escape pod for sure.
Yeah,
But yeah, on Trump Force One, the four food groups were KFC, McDonald's, pizza, and Diet Coke. So,
ain't that America?
It's pretty American.
Yeah.
What were we talking about? Dowd. Yeah. So I mean that smelled like trying to save Trump's bacon, which is not unusual. We keep seeing all these people, like normally sensible people, even just throwing themselves on grenades for Trump, and you're like, why? Why? Like, what is it about Trump that makes these people take complete leave of their senses and go, like, I am going to sacrifice my life or my political career or my common sense to protect this weirdo who eats Big Macs all day and tweets
watches
all night.
Watches Fox News till he passes out.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's exhibit one. Exhibit two with the Flynn thing is... he's owned by Mueller now. It's, I found a New York article, or it was from New York Magazine, that just like listed all of this malfeasance that Flynn is either been proved to be involved in or alleged to be involved in. That went right up to yesterday's revelation that during Donald Trump's inauguration speech, he was tweeting a business partner that they were, quote, good to go. Concerning shredding up the Russia sanctions that were passed this time last year, and that this was going to be opening up business opportunities for them, presumably, because one of the things Flynn was involved in was advocating on behalf of Russian firms to build nuclear reactors in the Middle East. They actually went back to find footage of the inauguration. At the time the tweet was supposedly sent, you can see a picture of Michael Flynn sitting there. Not the tweet, the message, the text message. You can see Michael Flynn sitting there tapping on his phone. So.
Smirking.
Well, you couldn't see the smirk from the back of his head, but probably. So Mueller has him in the crosshairs. He really had no choice because, as a lot of people have observed, people who know U.S. legal and federal investigation methods and processes a lot better than I do, obviously, that you don't when you got this much going against you and you're given a plea deal to cop to lying to the FBI, they've kind of got you. They've got you. They've just given you a gift that he's going to probably get off. Probably not even with jail time. So forget about the lock him up stuff. But probably at the very least. House arrest, maybe. Serious fines. It's I'm not sure where that's going to go, but yeah, he's in deep trouble, and he owes it to Mueller and his team to come up with something pretty pretty decisive. And they're pointing to three main targets, including Donald Trump himself, the president, Fredo Trump, his eldest son, and Jared Kushner. I mean,
what
Donald
was
Trump
that again. Alfredo.
Fredo.
Yes.
But
primo e secondo. Yes.
Yeah. And then Jared Kushner, of course, as well, who once again, like last week, had to go back to his security clearance forms and submit amendments. And, it's not for the rational among us. It's not hard to see that this is an administration that's very, very dirty. And, it makes you wonder how deep the rabbit hole goes when you have dogged investigators on it.
I always think of that line at the end of Casablanca, round up the usual suspects. That's what I think. And they line everybody up and say, yeah. But as to what you were saying about why are these people willing to jump on the grenade to protect Trump, it's because there's something in the background there that somebody has the goods on or will get the goods on, a la Flynn. And I would say most of the people, a lot of this not solidly proven. I think that the talk of Flynn and the tweeting was from a whistleblower, right? As yet unnamed.
So that was somebody who tipped off Elijah Cummings, I think.
And that's, there is, well, whistleblower protection is one thing, but once that's out there, and it's like, in fact, you know, if they are able to get the records and go through everything, it's... Speaking of records, I'd heard that the special counsel has requested Trump's bank records from Deutsche Bank. Yeah. So what's, I mean, that's, Deutsche Bank's a pretty large firm and also straight up. I don't know if they're looking for the money trail. I'm surprised that more didn't come out in the, as we've talked about, the Panama Papers and the Paradise Papers. But this, you know, this is a
right. Well, how much about Russia was there in the Paradise Papers and the Panama Papers? There wasn't much, was there?
No, but if, you know, it's, if you're getting money from Russia, allegedly, presumably, and wanted to stash it somewhere, that's, well, it's sort of secondary to where the origins, you don't get the origin story of the money, but it's like, hey, he got $10 billion. Why did it go over here? Where did it come from? And then they would have to do the forensic backtracking, I guess, to try and determine where that came from, which probably next to impossible.
Well, there's some,
I sold the building, whatever.
I mean, there's some sketchy situation. There was that one building that in 2008 that he sold to a Russian millionaire for an exorbitant amount of money. And, you know, things like the Azerbaijan deal that Ivanka Trump had a hand in, where it has, like, sketchy, like, Republican guard money involved in it and everything. You know, it's possible it's off the books, but, it, you know, that's probably why, you know, they're going after for detailed bank records. But, of course, that before was mentioned as the red line that, you know, if Donald Trump's, you know, going after his financial records was a red line. No, you know, that's a no-no. And that doesn't just go for Robert Mueller. That went for Comedy Central, too, when they did the Donald Trump roast. You can make fun of his net wealth. You know, you can make fun of just about everything else, including how he threw black families out of housing. But you can make fun of his wallet size. So, I mean, there's something there that he desperately wants to conceal. And whether or not that's where he gets funding for his buildings, likely, or whether or not that he's got a smaller bank account than he likes to let on, more likely. But it's tricky for him because the noose is getting shorter and shorter.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, everything they scratch on the scratch card comes up Russia. All the people, you know, it's like Russia, Russia, Russia. Kushner was in
Russia.
It's getting to be a bit much. It's like, okay, there's every single person you can connect the dots to Russia or Russian interests or Russian business or one of the stands with a Russian involved. At least that seems to be the pattern. And just, you know, speaking of Nixon, can you imagine this going on in his... Oh, my goodness.
Well,
it would bring everything down back then, but now it's just like, well, there are friends in business and oil and blah, blah, blah. So, and nuclear power. The nuclear power deal is like, wow, like... Think about it here, and we're going to talk about it in a bit, about declaring conflicts of interest or whatever. It's like this whole government is a conflict of interest. It's like built on conflict of interest.
Well, that's a good segue for what we're going to do going to in a minute.
Yes.
But the latest news of all this was Donald Trump Jr. was testifying in front of one of the congressional committees yesterday, and he refused to answer a question about talking to his father about an email because of attorney-client privilege. Because there was a lawyer in the room, I guess.
I see a lawyer. But
it reminds me of what's his name? The elf, Jeff Sessions. he goes into these committee meetings and he says, "Oh, I can't talk about that. That's between me and the president." And they're like, "Did the president exert executive privilege?" "Oh no, I just can't talk about it." And it's just, "No, answer the question. You're before congressional committee. You answer the question." And that's what they should have done with Doju. They should have I mean, maybe it's because it's the first time he's testified before Congress, but so maybe they'll be a bit harder on him next time. But, you know, I'm pretty sure Doju would crack at the threat of prison. I mean, I'm kind of sick of I can't answer the question. And attorney-client privilege, I mean, that's like something you'd watch a sitcom and there's a character pretending to be a lawyer. That's like something they'd pull out of their hat. It's like, oh, I can't talk about it because of attorney-client privilege. You're not a lawyer.
Or they talk out the clock, right? They do that whole draw it out points of whatever and points of this and that. Full marks for the Sessions impersonation, by the way. So. That's a win. We decided that one day we're going to do a whole show just as other people, but we haven't quite mastered that yet, but it's coming. Yeah,
well,
I don't know how to impersonate Bill Monroe, though. Or Bill Monroe.
Bill Monroe.
Bill Monroe. That's
I could
folky.
Not tell you what his voice is. It's like I've heard him talk several times, but I'm not.
It's classic business voice, I guess. But so anyway, we'll use our voices to talk about Bill Monroe, I guess, at this point. How's that for a segue?
That was terrible, but it's fine. We're getting there anyway. Yeah, Bill Morneau, you may know as federal finance minister, been in hot water. Chantal Hébert, bless her, actually did the math on this, and I don't think I wrote the math down, but basically, like,
Was this the 200 times?
Yeah,
asked him 200 times?
Yeah. All these questions, like, they ask him 15 questions every question period. That's the number where they ask Bill Morneau about, you know, his conflicts of interest and his status. And
it's always, when will the minister do the honorable thing? That's always the line, right? It's
yeah.
Like, okay, you want to resign? We know.
When will Andrew Scheer do the honorable thing and pull those awful ads off television? That's what I want.
Are they still on? Yeah, I
saw one earlier this week. It's
I don't know if they come through the air, but.
You're not personable, Andrew. You don't have it like Trudeau.
He goes
and
by
Singh.
The bench and goes, hi. It's like,
No. That's not how it goes. He's walking down the street and the people sitting on the bench go, oh, hi, Andrew. And he's like, and then he stops like, oh, yeah, I'm supposed to be personable. Yeah. Hi. And then he keeps going.
It's like the room. Oh, hi, Andrew.
Oh, yeah. Hi, Andrew.
Anyway, enough about cheer.
Great story, Andrew.
Oh, my God. The room featuring.
Coming up on end credits, by the
yes.
way.
Yes. Oh, excellent.
What were we talking about?
The 200 questions.
Yes.
When will he do the honorable thing and resign?
Bill Morneau. Yeah, I mean, that's funny. Because Justin Ling posted this thing on The Walrus. And it's like, you know what, you may hate, you know, rich people like Bill Morneau, and hey, why not? But he hasn't done anything illegal. I mean, it's, you know, when you're talking about rich people with a lot of money and how they have to, like, handle that in the commons and when their government have to make sure they're not, like, interfering in conflict of interest, that's all understandable. But the fact of the matter is, he hasn't, like, done anything. And in fact, has followed in the lead of the ethics commissioner who's, you know, kind of guided him on like how to treat his vast wealth.
Yeah.
And so he's been kind of following that lead. And it's like, yeah, you want to go after Richie Rich Morneau, that's fine. But he doesn't have to resign.
No. And they'll keep hammering it until they can't hammer it anymore. But that this is the thing about Morneau is that he seems to me like the kind of guy that is probably like a natural born conservative.
Yeah.
I mean, he came. I wouldn't say he came out of nowhere. I mean, Morneau Chappelle is a well-known company in that. But
family
you don't,
company.
If, you know, going back, would you picture this guy as a liberal? Probably not. He seems cut from the, let's say, the conservative cloth and the standard person that they would put forward. And of course, you need somebody that you
he's
know,
a red Tory type.
He's yes,
like
exactly.
Ignatieff.
Because he and you know, I suppose you could argue the same thing about Trudeau if you're just talking about people with sheer wealth, because they're both millionaires. And I think it sounds like Morneau more so than Trudeau.
Oh, yeah.
So you've still got the millionaires running the show, and then the conservatives are phrasing it. So it's like, okay, well, this guy should step down because he didn't declare this, he didn't declare that. Now, he did get fined. It was a small fine. It was something like $200 or something for not revealing some assets.
You know,
it's
what
like, I forgot about the villa.
He didn't forget about the villa.
He was selling some shares or something.
On a form, he didn't write with the company that owns the villa, which is just bizarre to me. When you're rich, you own a vacation home, and so you form a company that is
that
like
must
the
be
owner
for taxes, though, right? It must.
It's definitely for taxes, but it's bizarre. Who thinks like that? But other than rich people, you know, if you have a cottage, you just own a cottage. Anyway.
There's a tax line for that somewhere, too, right? It's my office.
That's my office.
It's my office. I do all my work there.
It's my satellite office. No, it's he told the ethics commissioner about the villa, but he didn't include on the forms the numbered company that owns the villa, so he got the $200 fine.
Yes. So, I mean, that's minor.
He pulled a Kushner.
Maybe not quite to that degree, but yeah, so... It just seemed to me funny that the party of the wealthy elites is going after this guy. Will he step down? Probably not. It doesn't seem like he's going to, unless they found mortar. Because it's who was writing about? Was it Andrew Quinn? As you say, it's like the guy. It may seem a bit sketch, But if there's no rules broken, then there's no rules broken. But then it was getting a bit heated, too. He's sort of like, yo, let's... It was not... It wasn't phrased, let's take it outside, but it was like, I want to him say the same thing outside of the House because of parliamentary privilege.
That's right. He wanted to see, take
I
it
outside. I want to see you say this outside. Because
I want to see you make public statements outside so then I can sue you, basically.
The lawsuit would come so fast. Right. Not unlike Kathleen Wynne and Brown in this province where...
Hey, look what happened to that, right?
Yeah, exactly. So as to whether... they will start saying it outside of I was going to say City Hall. We're thinking about City Hall. So say it outside of Parliament. Probably not. But
no. As much as I'd love to see an Andrew Scheer, Bill Morneau fight, it's not going to.
But
mean,
this, you know,
it's not going to happen
in the scheme of things. Let's say Morneau and his $200 fine. Scheer's not exactly. He's got his own little tax avoidance scheme going on as well.
Sure.
That doesn't get a lot of mention anymore.
Why not?
Buried in the files. I think we talked about it before, is that he has a one of these real estate limited partnership deals. It's with
with
a numbered company, and it is a bit of a tax loophole. If you do it this way, you save tax. So it's not as if he's, you know, Mr. walking down the street and just paying his tax bill. There's a loophole here.
He owns the street, which is what you're not hearing.
Yes. He owns that bench you're sitting on, kid. I don't know if I don't think he's independently wealthy, but, you know, everybody in the nation is always looking for somewhere to, whether it's your TFSA, which is very above board, or things like numbered companies, or, well, I forgot I had $40 million. I'm sorry, Morneau does not sound like Trump, for the record. But I forgot about this $40 million. Or what? No, it was 30,000 shares, $10 million. That's the sale that. The cons called it elitist and ethically challenged.
Right.
I don't know how it's, I would call it elite. They love using elitist. There's an elite sense to it. And is it ethically, I mean, you know, he followed the rules, so I don't know.
Well,
they're saying they're faulting him for his wealth.
Right. I think if you want to make an argument that maybe the ethics commissioner is a little lean.
Yeah.
Or lenient with Morneau and maybe people like Morneau. Sure, go ahead and make that point. But, you know, you can't have somebody who he set up a conflict screen, too, which is basically if you own a railroad, and this is how Justin Ling laid it out. If you own a railroad and then you go to the ethics commissioner and say, I have a railroad, they'll set up a conflict screen. If you're made like Minister of Transportation or something, they set up a conflict screen so that nothing involving a railroad even makes it to your desk.
Yeah.
So,
but when something involves pensions and Morneau is a pension company, right?
Right. Like, and this is this is Ling's interesting point where this thing, Bill 27 came up, Bill C-27, which is going to loosen rules for federally regulated companies, which theoretically was going to create more businesses for pension funds and pension managers like Morneau, Scheppel. But the way Ling explained it is, it's like, if you're in office and you own an ice cream company and a decision crosses your desk to like cut the output of air conditioners and the side effect is going to be people are buying more ice cream
more
to
gelato.
Stay cool. But the point is, it isn't just your ice cream people can buy. It's any ice cream. It's like, well, yeah, he has a pension company, but anyone can go to any pension company and engage in services. So it looks sketchy, but it's not. I mean, depending on how you look at it, it looks sketchy. It's just, you know, I think the
you can
argument,
make it look sketchy, right?
Like, yes, but it's not completely above board. Let's call it, but it's not illegal. And he isn't endorsing his own company through this,
no,
either.
And I guess it's hands off for him now. He's not on the board anymore, right?
He's put it in a blind trust.
He stepped back. Yeah. He says he has no company ties. He was the chairman at one point, right?
Yeah.
And I think he stepped back from that to
he sold his shares,
the job that he's doing,
and just put his business in a blind trust, which is something the ethics commissioner didn't tell him to do.
And I'm sure if he wanted a gig when it was all over, he could probably go back because guys do it all the time, especially the
his
lawyers,
name's right? on the door.
Yeah, so
the
office is still there; it's just not bricked up, but the door has been closed, and occasionally somebody does the housekeeping, right? Probably
one would hope.
Yeah, so that's what's going on. It's not as if he has distanced himself from the company, but at the same time. You know, you can't really, like you say.
Yeah.
It's like Justin trying to distance himself from his father. You can't do that, right? He's always his dad. But, and I was, this kind of reminded me of the whole, the chopper last year.
Get the little chopper.
And the vacation and that whole kind of like, yeah. Well, he probably shouldn't have taken the chopper for security reasons, but were any laws broken? Probably not really.
Well, also, you know, when you've grown up as a Trudeau, you're probably going to have rich and influential friends. So
the richest, like the Aga Khan, yeah.
Right.
That would get much richer than the Aga Khan.
Right. So, you know what? Maybe...
Ambrose's friend whose boat she was on.
Right. In an ideal universe, maybe you don't go to your friend's private island. But, I mean, what's wrong with your writing, Justin? No, but seriously. I think we know how I feel about these money scandals. But...
do you feel about these money scandals?
Don't go.
Stop talking about it. All I had for Christmas was some Smarties and a...
Yeah. I had Smarties and a can of beer for Christmas.
A cracker.
And I got a mouse trap to finally deal with the mouse in my house.
Violin
it all came
place.
From the dollar store. It was ridiculous. Being someone who worked at the dollar store. Full disclosure.
I don't
want to be accused of conflict of interest.
Do you get a discount?
There's no discount at the dollar store.
It's 80 cents for you because you're a good guy.
Jeez. No. That would be interesting. God, where are we going with this? No, the thing is...
Oh, no.
I think from coming back full circle to Scheer, I think from his point of view and from the Conservative Caucus point of view is like they have their Senate scandal. They have their Duffy. They have their Wallen. And they're going to ride this thing. And really, I think what they have is their what was that guy's name? Brazeau, not Brazeau. Anyway.
Wizzo. No, Brazeau.
Oh, man. We're just... callbacks all over the place, but yes. They think this is a Senate scandal. It's not a Senate scandal, and you know, in so much as I wish like Trudeau's people would button this kind of stuff up so that we don't get bogged down in this kind of ridiculousness. And it's the point remains, as Lane points out, he's not guilty of anything. So let's move on. Sure, like 3 months later, let's move on.
Yeah, and how quickly forget the Senate scandal was mostly conservative. I guess there are no named senators now. The two new senators are both named Mary, but they're not liberals, right? So it's...
They're the Mary caucus.
The Mary caucus, I guess so. No, we're not really liberals, but Justin appointed us, so...
Well,
but
I believe
scandalous.
Justin recommends, and from the application process, and then Governor General appoints. Civics lesson for the day.
Absolutely, there you go.
Speaking
anything
of-
procedural, this is the guy. I turn to him and say, hey.
Oh, man. Pressure. Speaking of pressure, we got two city councilors coming in next to talk about Guelph budget stuff. So that's after the break. You are listening, of course, to Open Sources Guelph. You're on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
She's been talking to some jabroni in an Orange County chopper shirt all night. And I say, Jesus, is she gonna go home with him? And Jesus says, well, B.A. not on my watch. And then the locusts, they fly in. And the jabroni, he's got no skin. I always knew that Jesus was from Hamilton. I always knew that Jesus was from Hamilton.
That was B.A. Johnson. That wasn't me. That was B.A. Johnson from his album, My Heart is a Blinking Nintendo. And that was... As close as we'll get to a Christmas song, that's...
And he's holding a dead squirrel.
I don't think that's... I think it might be his dad on the back. Jesus is from Steeltown. That's the closest we'll get. So,
Jesus.
I wanted to play the Christmas song, but it had too many swears in it, so I had to pick something else. B.A. sings a Christmas song.
That's rich.
So anyway, he's from Hamilton. He plays here a lot, so he's probably going to be here like any minute now. So anyway, check him out. B.A. Johnson.
He's like, that wasn't a dead squirrel. Anyway. We're pleased to have in studio Councillors Phil Ault and Councillor Kathy Downer. Thank you guys so much. I know it's been a very busy week, and it's a very busy week next week as well with merger Electra. I'm not going to talk about that today because we're all about the budget today. So just first, is that funny?
Did I say?
Anyway.
It was shocking.
Oh, was it shocking?
It was a shocker.
Oh, my goodness. So I did want to start by talking generally about the process and how you guys feel about it. Not necessarily what happened on Tuesday, but what happened, you know, throughout. I know that did come up rather prominently at one point in terms of how things went and what order things are done in. So how did this one feel as compared to the past ones?
Process-wise, leading up to like the budget, I really liked the message board thing where and that it was public this year. Before, there was a message board for councillors, and not many councillors used it. So this year, it was a public message board, and so the public could check in to see what people were asking and getting more answers. So I just thought there was a lot of information beforehand, and so I thought that went good. On budget night, we did it the same as last year. There's pros and cons to leaving the whole thing to vote on at the end. And, you know, that could be debated depending on what side of the fence you're on for each different budget. So, that's the process that was decided upon for this year. And maybe it's something that they should review to make sure everybody's okay with it next year.
Mm-hmm. I thought that the process leading up to it was reasonably good. There were a couple of points that I disagree with Councillor Downer on. But first and foremost, the one thing that I want to do is thank the staff for their earnest commitment to making certain that we had the information available to us. Kathy has talked about the bulletin board, and I have a slight caveat on that. I have some concerns with the public nature of the bulletin board. Not that people can look in and read what's going on, but that are permitted to answer questions, because from my point of view, the bulletin board is intended to clarify information from the professionals who are providing us with the advice on elements of the budget. And I found that particularly problematic in one instance. So, Kathy, one of the things that I will be recommending is that we look at how the bulletin board actually operates, and maybe we even need to perhaps have two bulletin boards, one where councillors can ask specific questions of the budget to staff so that the rapport can be staffed to council as questions of clarification, and another for the public so that issues can be clarified for the public in a different fashion. There were times when I wasn't certain whether I was getting information from staff or from a member of the public. Have we got a jet coming through here, or what is that? So there was that concern. In terms of the final vote, Kathy made mention of having voted on the budget as separate packages.
Live radio, folks, live radio.
And I have some concerns with voting on separate elements of a package. A budget is a budget.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's a federal budget or a provincial budget or a city budget, the issue of the different packages, the different envelopes, is that they are, for all intents and purposes, in balance. And unlike Kathy, I didn't think that when Councillor Salisbury said, I have a problem with this, because this the way that we're dealing with this budget might mean that I might have to vote against another part of it. I think he's absolutely correct.
Yeah.
We're voting on a budget where the taxpayers, you and Scott, when you receive your property taxes, will be receiving an announcement of an increase on your property assessment. And that includes all aspects of the budget. So it confuses people. Did I vote for the budget? Yeah, I voted for the budget. Did I vote for the levy? No, I didn't.
Mm.
What does that mean? I can say quite clearly that I did not vote for the total increase in your taxes this year.
Right. Would that be resolved, you think, if it came down to like there was like a final motion?
Absolutely.
Well, see, no, I disagree, because we've had that in
right.
the first term, and you remember what happened in the mm-hmm. first year. What happens is that, you know, then people who have voted for stuff all the way through at the end say, oh, no, this is just too high. I'm going to vote against this. And so so there's problems with both, right? So, and I'm not sure how you fix that. But it depends on, again, what window you're looking through, whether you disagree or disagree with the budget. So we've done both this term. We did for the first 2 years, you voted on the whole package at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody complained last year when we did it this way. And so this year, my only concern with Councillor Salisbury, it wasn't that, you know, he dislike this process. It's at the moment that he decided to announce that he disliked the process.
Right.
So you get near the end of a process and you don't like what what's happening and you say, oh, I don't like this process, let's change the process, mm-hmm. I think is sort of anyway, I didn't like that. So
yeah, and fair enough. I understand why you didn't like it. On the other hand, I think that Mike was raising a procedural problem that we have with voting for the budget in separate packages. The end ratification clearly and definitively announces that we have a budget. And the truth is, we should be working toward consensus on a total package. Mm. And that means that we as a council are satisfied that we've done our horse trading, veterinary college, I think I can say that, and that our horse trading has led us to something that we believe. There are points that we agree with, points we don't agree with, but overall, we are putting together what we believe delivers a quality budget for quality life in the city of Guelph moving forward. And there were clearly people around that table who did not feel that we had done that, mm-hmm. and that we have actually, for the next budget, left the next council with a lump of coal in their stocking.
Have you been talking to Carl Wettstein?
Oh, Carl.
That's the phrase he left me.
When I'm trying to get to sleep, you know, at midnight, he'll call me. Just before I want to wake up, he'll call me. And yes, indeed, he actually said that we have left next council with the potential for starting our budget with needing to increase the budget. We don't have a zero base. We have at least a 1.6 base. And the way that he sent it to me just recently is that actually we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 expansions that he considers are actually not expansions at all, that total $1.3 million, if I've got it correctly, that add on to the 1.6% that we have to add. So there you go.
I hope I get to say something.
She's there.
Point of order. Yeah, point of order.
Just to Councillor Southworth, just to reiterate again, we did this the way last year, mm-hmm. and we proposed to do it again this year, and Councillor Southworth had every opportunity in the last year and a half to say he didn't like the process. So mm-hmm. so that was my issue. I don't necessarily disagree with Councillor Ault. It's actually 0.6. We'd be looking at 0.1 next year anyway. Like the 1% levy is already embedded in, and where the plan was to
an additional
1% every year. So we're mm-hmm. actually looking at a 0.6 when we go in next year, and with an expectation that staff will be recommending the 1%. But what surprises me about Councillor Wettstein is, he was saying to me that he'd rather use the rate stabilization fund for the tax rate. So if you're looking at it for the tax rate, you're still looking at that same shortfall for next year. And I don't disagree about the positions. It's about, what Carl and I were debating about. Well, where do you use the rate stabilization fund, if you use it at all? So, and I know some wouldn't want to use it at all, but Carl was willing to use it for the rate, and I was willing to use it for the levy. So that would be the only difference. Yeah. So.
But, I don't want to get between you and Carl. And I believe that, I think that actually
Leanne Piper. We sit beside each other.
So I won't. But the one point that I think needs to be made is the one time that Councillor Wettstein used it. It was for $500,000 as opposed to $1.6 million. And that's a significant difference when our actual rate stabilization is about $6 million below where it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be at 11. The other issue that really has to be raised when we are that low, we're trying to build it up, is do two wrongs make a right? Mm. And does the second wrong, which is three times Councillor Wettstein's first wrong, therefore make a triple wrong?
Well, that's what I said. That's another debate, right? Yeah. Whether you use it at all or whether we should have just gone with a 4.4% increase this year along with a few other things.
Right. Well, that's what I'm thinking is, I think there's a magic line at 3%. And that's, Councillor McKinnon literally said that, like, my magic line is, not those exact words, but to paraphrase, he said, like, my red line is 3%.
Yeah.
And I think he articulated something there that I think all of council feels, that when it gets to 3%, Phil's shaking his head, but I think there are several people on council for whom 3% is where the invisible wall is, and then they hit the wall, and that's that.
No, I think that there's a different way to look at it, and that is the question of whether it's 0%, 10%, or minus 10%, mm-hmm. what are we delivering for the future? Mm-hmm. And there are a number of issues that we have to address. Are we impairing ourselves in the future by establishing an artificial ceiling on the budget. Because now we have to go back in, understanding that next year, the next council, it's an election year, will ultimately have to address a shortfall in what we did in terms of our base this year. And that, to me, is somewhat problematic.
No, and I don't doubt the – sorry to cut you off, but I don't doubt the problems that come from that. But it is a political –
balancing act.
It's a political balance, and it's an optical thing, because I think people look at the three and do get concerned, and whether it's justified or not, Guelph is a growing city, and maybe this gets into how we fund cities and the shortfall therein. But you know, it's tricky, because on the one hand, you're sort of in there and you know what the city needs, whether it's infrastructure gap, whether it's, you know, staff to fill in a growing and expanding city and to fill those functions. But people start hearing 4%, 4.4, 4.8%, and they start seeing, you know, visions of councillors with beluga caviar in their heads,
so
right?
I've been through 14 budgets, right? 14 or 15 budgets. So, you know, and I don't find that when you don't fund, if you don't fund one thing, the 0% years were problematic. But when you don't fund, sometimes those things go off the radar in the next year. There are a number of expansions that didn't come back this year that were there last year. And I would have been quite happy to approve more of expansions than we did, but the 4.4 was problematic for me, and I agree. There's around the 3%, and there are people, like young couples and people living in homes that are living paycheck to paycheck. And while some say, well, it's only a cup of coffee or something like that, but in reality, it's diapers for the kids, right? So
yeah.
I think we have to be somewhat careful about that. But I've always been quite, you know, open to sort of, you know, looking at 3 to 0.35, but I'm very reluctant to go over those numbers. And I have supported that this term.
And I just see it a different way altogether. I think that fundamentally our job is to pull together a quality budget. And because we have been elected, and theoretically at least some of us would run for re-election, our job is to justify what we are doing to the community. And and I get where Kathy's coming from. We can say that the increase is only $20 or a case of beer or diapers or whatever. That doesn't necessarily wash with people, and I accept that. My problem is, as I said, the fundamental principle of how do you build a city. And I know that one area that where Kathy and I absolutely agree on is that expansion of the city doesn't pay for itself. And we are running into a serious problem in Guelph, because we are now about to embark on the Maltby subdivision. And because of the principles of development, we are going to have to pay for that in the future. And that could potentially lead us to some huge tax increases that are going to have an impact on everything from infrastructure to culture to arts to recreational facilities. And then the 3% becomes somewhat moot. What do people need to live within the new subdivision and the rest of Guelph when we have to repair infrastructure and provide the kinds of services that people want?
Yeah, and I guess I think the focus is on always the rate increase itself. But I do want to get into the idea that, you know, we do have a provincial election next year. We have a municipal election next year. I think there's opportunity there to have kind of like a two-parter discussion of, you know, how cities are funded, because I think we're looking at things we've talked about in terms of the provincial so far, things like healthcare, things like education, things like, you know, public transit as well came out of the PC platform. But I think the one thing no one ever touches is funding of cities, which, you know, when you're in a city in Ontario, you only have so many options in terms of how you raise funds. And unlike the other levels, when the bad years are bad, we can't go into debt like they can.
It's not just cities, it's municipalities. So I'm on the Board of Association of Municipalities. And, you know, that's stable funding from the province has become a huge issue. Right. So, and they've come up with that 1%. HST tax, right? So that, the dedicated tax that would go to municipalities for infrastructure renewal. Then we could all get rid of our levies, right? And they believe that fair, and they spent 2 years researching that. And I think that's, you know, you're right. It's a good discussion to have at a good timely discussion. They've all come out and said they're not supporting that. But
yeah.
But then if not that, then what kind of stable funding you know, should they be looking at for municipalities? But it's and you know, the formula is in the Development Charges Act. I mean, that's, you know, we're talking about that. That happened in the Mike Harris years. That
yeah.
That became really problematic.
Yeah, and Kathy's quite correct. I mean, one of the things that people need to appreciate about cities is that cities have no authority in law.
Yeah,
we are nothing but orphaned children of the province, and it is the provinces that are determining for us how we raise our funds. And so where the Association of Municipalities comes out and states that we'd really like 1%, and I think it's quite valid, the provinces flat out said no.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the frustration. What they've done is they've said, we promise we will not increase taxes. The federal government has said, we promise not to increase taxes. They continue to download to us,
yeah.
Say that the cities are responsible for that. Also claim that we're responsible for affordable housing, for paramedics, for court services.
Yeah.
And we are getting further and further behind the eight ball. And then what happens? The cities get blamed for raising taxes. Whereas
yeah.
We're not doing that. We're actually subsidizing the province and the federal government.
Yeah, and that's an interesting way to look at it. And, you know, because even when you have, you know, Justin Trudeau a couple of weeks ago comes down and talks about national housing strategy, and even that's dependent on matching funds from the province too. So even when they're coming out with more funding, it's
just handouts every now and then. It's not
yeah,
stable. It's not
right.
consistent.
Well, it's not even that. The federal government has not put one extra penny into affordable housing yet.
Yeah.
They've promised it only.
Yeah.
You know, where's the beef? That's what I want to know. They want the cities to commit to affordable housing, but at the same time, they're not giving us any indication that they're actually committed to it. I'm sorry. I think that they're too busy smoking their illegal dope.
Kids, ask your parents about where's the beef.
oh, we're getting old there, young whippersnapper.
the affordable housing thing is... No, gasp. But the 100,000 for the neighborhood coalition. I understand why that rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. I can't remember who used the actual robbing Peter to pay Paul metaphor, but it's apt. Was it you?
Yeah.
Okay. But I do wonder how quickly affordable housing is going to come. And there were a couple of interests, and I think you clarified things with Ed Pickersgill on Facebook the other day about it, was that, when we're talking about affordable housing, we're not talking about social housing. We're not talking about the people who are most in need. We're talking about money that is basically being put aside to hopefully persuade developers not to maximize profit and
that's right.
make stuff a
so
little bit
that,
more cheaper for people.
So that reserve is for that. But
yeah.
It is also for, like I said, I think the last place we used it was at Michael's house, right?
Mm.
So, and that is for that, you know, those people, more vulnerable people as mm-hmm. well. So it helped to fund that type of housing, an affordable type of housing. So
right.
I think it was... I think it was really unfortunate that they played one off against the other in that. I was really happy for the Guelph Neighborhood Support Coalition.
Right.
I'm glad to see they're able to continue to expand. So.
Yeah. I mean, it's absolutely ludicrous to play organizations off against each other
yeah.
or like play the police off against the coalition.
Right.
However, in dealing with the affordable housing piece, it is problematic because nobody understands for the most part that we are not talking about the old social housing programs.
Right.
The most successful housing program that we ever had in Guelph was the social housing program that was eliminated by Brian Mulroney 30 years ago now. We were able, within less than 10 years, to put in over 300 units of affordable housing in Guelph because of a federal and provincial commitment. That was killed by the federal and the provincial governments. It was downloaded to the cities. What do we have in our funds? Just under $1 million.
Yeah.
And then you're going to ask me, how am I going to afford to pay for affordable housing? There's a bit of a mythology there. And
yeah.
and as much as I'm supportive of putting as much housing in the ground as possible for people to afford, the reality is the cities can't do it.
Right.
It's a federal and a provincial program.
Right.
And that creates a real issue for many of us. I just don't like councillors ever playing off parts of budget against each other. I think it's wrong.
Sure. I thought it was important to clarify, though, because I think there was a moment for a lot of council thought, you know, probably confused the social housing and the affordable housing aspect.
All the time.
Yeah, and I was guilty of that, too. So yeah. I thought it was just important to clarify.
Just to let you know, Jim Estill, the owner of Danby, sent me a proposal the other day for what we could use our affordable housing money for, and I think it's actually a great idea. It actually involves recognizing the need for basement apartments and granny flats and providing impetus for people to actually convert those. But it takes a will of both council and the public to understand that it's an intensification within current neighborhoods.
Problem is that though we don't have any we're very successful with the upper basement apartments. We don't really need to incentivize that because it's very successful, the basement apartments. It's the other type of housing that we need.
One bedroom apartments and
more, and basement apartments don't tend to be accessible, so that's a bit.
Exactly, that's the problem.
It's a kind of house. It's a different type of housing that we need. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, the basement apartment thing is one thing that Guelph, I think, has over other communities. We were one of the first to sort of register them. Other communities had them, but they were all illegal. But we registered them. And
what Estelle was saying, there's some people that would like to do it that can't afford it.
Right.
Is there not money available from the city to provide for the fire walls and so on and so forth that are absolutely necessary? It's a great idea worth looking at. Maybe we can.
Well, it's almost akin to a different variation on things like, you know, the water conservation methods of the city of Guelph, like installing, low-flow toilets and other things, rain barrels, that kind of thing, the way to create sustainability by helping out homeowners. Mm-hmm. Maybe in our last couple of minutes, I did want to address the security guard thing because I wonder, we have new money for a pilot project at the library for a security guard. We have security guards in City Hall coming, or more permanent security guards. You mentioned the policing budget. I wonder if there's a discussion at some point, and maybe in terms of what policing looks like downtown, that if we're getting security at the library, getting security at City Hall, you know, where else is there going to be security next? Mm-hmm. Like in, you know, maybe Old Quebec Street Mall, the train station, you know.
Where they are there.
It's an interesting issue because, first of all, A, I don't want to turn downtown Guelph into a police state, per se. And B, I want to take the security off of the City Hall. So the security guard, actually, the principle that was presented by our CAO, Derek Thompson, is one that sits well with me. Mm-hmm. The issue of policing in the downtown and policing every workforce is somewhat problematic. We don't afford that kind of protection to everyone in their workforce.
Right.
But the library is unique because it's a shelter and a protection area for many people who are either homeless or are essentially wandering downtown and quite often are suffering from significant mental debilitations and sometimes become violent. And so as a result of that, we need to look at the issue of protection of a vulnerable staff as well as protection of a vulnerable population.
Right.
It's not an easy issue to deal with. I'm supportive of both the security guards in both City Hall and in the library.
Sure. I just wonder if maybe it's a Band-Aid and maybe it's a whole more holistic discussion we have to have. I mean, until recently there was a place downtown where vulnerable people could go, and it is now not there. I'm the Out of Poverty Society that mm-hmm. drew a lot of people. And I think it was on one of the podcasts that, you know, I had a discussion with somebody. It's like, you know, maybe the fact Out of Poverty isn't there is a fact we kind of see more of a need.
It really is. And credit to everybody downtown who is working with those who are less fortunate. The Chalmers Church to mm-hmm. Carden Street to the drop-in center, and so on and so forth. They're all doing a great job. They're also not part of the city's infrastructure.
Right.
And that's there's the rub.
So the security guards are already there, but they're bylaw officers, right? So
mm-hmm.
that's the reality. So they're just correcting a situation to allow bylaw to do more.
To do their job.
To do their job, which they're not able to do because they're acting as security guards. So, and they talked about it helping to open up the City Hall a bit more. But you're right.
Did you vote in favor of that as well? I'm just curious. I can't remember.
Yeah, I brought it forward. You're right about the prevention stuff. And I think that's why, you know, supporting groups like the Guelph Neighborhood Support coalition that do that connection and outreach with people is really important. But a lot of the social service work that you're talking about lies with the county, which is problematic in that other whole relationship that we have that we don't have a lot of control over.
That's another can of worms.
And just to be clear, the Neighborhood Support Coalition does not do the work of the police.
Fair enough. Any ad hominem attacks before we wrap?
No.
Well, Councillor Ault, Councillor Downa, thank you so much for coming in today and adding some clarity. And we appreciate it. And in case we don't see you, have a good holiday season.
Nice.
And
you too.
Thanks for helping to keep news media alive. Happy holiday.
That's right.
We do our best, and we will do our best next week on the show. In the meantime, you can stay connected with us at opensourcesguelph.com. Go to Facebook at Open Sources Newswire, at @OS_Guelph on the Twitters, and you can listen to this and past episodes of Open Sources on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. You can find me on Twitter at Adam H. Donaldson, or go to guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca.
Scotty Hertz, Google me. We're out of time. Bye.
And DJ Sounds Good to Me is here at the top of the hour on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And we will be back here next week at 5 p.m. from our Open Sources. Bye.